Kia ora whānau, hope everybody's good. Today on the podcast, I'm very, very fortunate to have Alyssa Wilson-Hetty. How are you, Alyssa?
I'm very well, thank you.
Am I saying your name? Is it Alyssa or Alicia?
It's Alicia.
Why you're so nice, you didn't just jump in and go, excuse me, it's Alicia.
It's absolutely fine. I've heard every variation possible of my name over the course of my life. So,
what's the worst one you've had?
Well, someone thought they'd just throw an F in there. I don't know where they got the F from because my name starts with E. So Felicia. I was like, okay.
Cool. Bit of a remix.
Yeah, whatever. Cool. Sweet. We love it. Not really, but you know.
Yeah. I'm very lucky. My name has three letters. And yeah, but I have had when my Māori name comes out, when Timoti comes out, oh my gosh. I'm like, it's only Oti at the end of it.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it's Timoti. It gets crazy.
Yeah, I can fully relate to that.
Anyway, how are you? How you been?
I'm very well, thank you. I've been very busy. So it's quite nice just to have a moment to decompress a little bit.
Yeah. So the people at home that do not know you, I've gone in and I know, but what would be a couple of hats that you put on that in your profession?
Let me just introduce myself, eh? So my name is Alicia Wilson-Hetty. I am of mixed Niuean English heritage. I am based in Mangere in Tamaki Makaurau. I am a performance artist and producer. I also am a fat model for a fat brand called Infamy Apparel, who are also based out here in Tamaki Makaurau. I am an activist and an all-round troublemaker, generally, yarn spinner. I wear many kind of hats, and I'm also one of the members of Queer Arts Collective FASWAG.
When you first came on my radar, that's how I was like, oh, it's the fuff swag. And I was like, oh, okay, I get this now. And that's why I was so intrigued, because growing up in South Auckland, you meet fafafingas everywhere. They're they're at your school, your auntie, your mate's auntie, and everything going on. But they have this swag about them that is undeniable. It's and it's cool to kind of get you on it and to talk about that.
Thank you.
Because, I think it hasn't been represented in any media, or not a lot of media. I can't even think of any type of thing. So, how did that all begin?
Well, the collective, we're a group of friends, and that's kind of how it had started, of just a group of friends who all of us have our own arts practice and then a collective practice together. And I think we all felt an exhaustion around not actually seeing any representation of brown queer people in a mainstream consciousness. So I think that's kind of where it kind of was birthed from, was a real desire and want to see ourselves.
Because, can you name, I can't name anything that's been on mainstream TV that kind of, I don't know, encourages and enriches that kind of low. I can't. Do you know of any?
Well, not locally, really, to be honest with you. Internationally, I think we've been seeing queer people be a bit more visible in mainstream media for a little while now. But locally, there's really not a lot, which is why it's important for our community to kind of just take control of that, really, yeah. I think.
Yeah. And also you did performance artists as well. You do some performance art, correct?
Yep, that's correct.
So, man, the basement, I've been to the basement twice in my lifetime, and every time has been really kind of not out the gate, but just a different, because there's nowhere else that you could do a show like that. Shows that are support the LGBTQ community, but also, be proud of it.
I love the basement. I was fortunate enough to be the 2020 producer in residence there last year, which were, they've now ended that program, unfortunately, but they've got other ways of supporting the community. And Fastwag was actually the first company in residence in, I want to say 2017, sorry. And so we presented three different bodies of work at the basement. I think the importance of a space like the basement is it is a space to for emerging practitioners and seasoned practitioners to like be able to put work, I guess, that is really pushing form, which is exciting. So there's a lot of experimental work that comes out of the basement, which is really, really exciting because there's not many other spaces in Tāmaki anyway where you can put on really super experimental work that is like pushing the form.
Can you explain to me like the process around building like a performance art piece or coming from an idea that you have? What's the process for you?
Well, for my process is based in a lot of research, to be honest with you. And so a couple of years ago, I was lucky enough to be cast in a work with 20 other women called The Plastic Orgasm. And so that was investigating mainstream representation of women in pornography. And so looking at, you know, desire and sexuality and gender and a whole bunch of other stuff. And when I was moving through that process with this group of women, I wasn't quite finished investigating what that was for myself as a brown woman. And so I decided that I wanted to make a work that was centering what does brown female desire and sexuality actually look like for me and some of the women I know. And so we had created this body of work together, the four of us, called Reclamation, and that's what we were investigating. So lots of conversations, other conversations with other women from the community. Like, we held a Talanoa at the very, very beginning stages of the development of the work, because I think it's quite important that there is a bit of range when you're having these really big, beefy conversations. Like, what does that actually look like for us as Indigenous women? And then conversations with a group of women I was working with, and then lots of research, because I'm a bit of a nerd like that, and I like things to be rooted in a bit more truth than just my thoughts, if that makes sense.
Have some backing to it,
And then so we developed that work over a month. We devised that and created the work together. And then we had a three-week season at the basement where we presented the work. And it was just, it was amazing. Like, it's amazing. And the conversations that I've had with women and people who have come and experienced that body of work, I still, even now, have women who have had conversations with me around how empowering that was for them to see brown women having a conversation about sex and it not be rooted in trauma. Because I think as well, when we are having these conversations as brown women, not always, but there tends to be, it's attached to trauma. So it was nice to have those conversations where they felt really empowered.
That's interesting that you say that, because I have been involved in things like that. And sometimes like talks like that become like an emotional dump site, you know?
Yeah.
You just kind of like, everybody's just dumping the trauma and dumping like, this is what happened to me. This is, sometimes that's not always the case moving forwards to kind of bring these issues to the light. Cause that needs to be kind of like the sole purpose of some of these, like this corridor that you had was around kind of putting light on, you know, sex and especially around in the Polynesian and Maori community, you know, it's kind of like the shush shush kind of thing. Oh, you know?
Absolutely. There's massive taboo attached to sex in general, isn't there? And I think that is a massive hangover from, you know, colonialism and Christianity and all those things. So trying to frame the conversation in a way that, like, we are having these thoughts or ideas around, well, what does pre-colonial sex look like? What did that look like for our ancestors? Do you know what I mean? Like, and also a thing that I was quite conscious of, mostly because I feel like there are enough people who have been making work from a place of trauma. And I don't want to be reductive of that because I think there's a place for that in the conversation as well.
Yes.
But for me in my own arts practice, I have been really fucking with this idea of, you know, as brown people, as marginalized people, our joy is actually super radical and super
Beautiful.
So what does it look like when we are sitting in joy? You know what I mean? What does it actually look like for brown people, for brown women, for brown queer women? Like, what does joy actually look like, and how political is our joy? Because I think in a system that has really conditioned us to think that we should be quiet and that we should just keep it all like here, what does it look like when you go, even though the system has conditioned me to think I should hate myself, I'm going to be radical in my joy? What does that look like?
What is something that you discovered, like pre-colonial, like what did you discover?
Well, I think, you know, in the current context of how we as Pacifica people look at gender and at sexuality is quite a colonial outlook, isn't it? It's very binary, when in actual fact, we're very fluid. And, you know, when you think of circling back to the beginning of the conversation and you talking about whawhawhine whakalaiti, when we look at that as a gender identity within the Pacific, that survived for a reason. Do you know what I mean? Like, when you think about that as a gender and you think about that as a spectrum, obviously pre-colonialism, pre-Christianity, we were very fluid. And it's these binaries that kind of keep, I think, really stifling all of us, to be honest with you. And Think about then how that feeds into this idea of patriarchy. You know what I mean? And like, I've been really mulling a lot over how patriarchy affects all of us, because I think sometimes we get stuck in this idea that the patriarchy is very hurtful and harmful to women. And don't get me wrong, it absolutely is. But when I've sat back and really thought about it, my opinion is that actually the patriarchy hurts men the most, I think.
Okay, elaborate on that for me.
Why I say that is because I think when I say that I think patriarchy has been really harmful to men, is because it has stifled men to think that there is a one very boxed in version of what masculinity is, what it means to be a man, without actually taking a step back, I guess, and going, well, masculinity, like femininity, is actually super fluid. And there's a lot of fluidity there. So if we're thinking about masculinity not being one or the other, but also this like really kind of fluid energy, then what does it actually look like for our men? Because I feel like, you know, it's no mistake that men make up a majority in the suicide stats. When you look at how this idea of masculinity, whatever that looks like, specifically in how I guess our brown men navigate that, and this weird conditioning that we condition our men to think, instead of just going, actually, it's just a spectrum like anything else. Like, you can just figure it out for yourself. It doesn't have to be one or the other. It can be a whole bunch of really beautiful stuff in the middle.
Yeah. And I mean, it's actually quite, I don't want to say funny, but it's ironic that, you know, like the stats for male suicide are huge, but also like for our Pacifica, for our Māori, they're even bigger because, you know, they're already marginalized and yet we've been put in this box of masculinity, but also just chuck in some fucking, some racism, just chuck in some just really, you know, like stereotypes and the stigma of being a Māori man or an island man and chuck all that in. No wonder why there's a massive gap between pālangi and Māori Pacifica men when it comes to the suicide rates. It makes fucking sense.
Absolutely. And I think there's these real cycles of violence that are perpetuated by our own people and the expectations that we put on our men instead of being able to hold our men with care, you know, and actually being able to hold space for our men to be complete, fully realized people, where it's not this idea of, well, to be a man, this is what a man is. Well, what does that even mean?
And yeah, I watched it. I want to get your comment on this too. I watched this thing the other day. It was Chris Rock, and he said, like, only so I think I don't know. He was joking, but there was a just a tint of truth in there. The unconditional love thing, you know, like, women get unconditional love, dogs get unconditional love, babies get unconditional love, but men don't, you know. And I thought about that. I let that marinate a little bit with me, and I was just like, damn, there's so much to unpack with that.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, a dog could go and fucking do something, and then all of a sudden, ah, it's all right, he's a dog, right? But then, yeah, I don't know. I'm still pondering on it, and I'd love to. I don't know if you've seen it, but it made me think. Like, there might be some truth to that.
Well, yeah, I guess it's because we've still got this hangover of these gendered roles, right? And what that looks like, and you know that I think we still box men into being like, well, to some degree, I guess not across the spectrum, but there is an idea that men are breadwinners or have been positioned that way, or providers, and da 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 da. And so I guess sometimes men do feel that maybe love is conditional, but also, once again, rolling back, that feeds into this idea of what is masculinity, what it means to be a man. If I am a man, these are the things that I need to do to provide. And I think that's always a challenge in unpacking that as a conversation. Because there's a whole lot of internalized stuff that we all carry as well, right? Like actually having to unlearn a whole bunch of stuff. And this is even for myself in my own journey, when I think about the concept of decolonization, what does it look like? You're constantly having to unlearn stuff. Even when I think about how that feeds into a conversation around fatness, right? Like, I have become quite comfortable with the language and using the word fat. It doesn't mean everybody is. That journey for myself, having to unpack my own internalized fat phobia about myself, but also other fat bodies, has been a continual journey. It's still something I'm navigating and figuring out.
Because that, I mean, if we start there, society is all about, like, you know, this is what you should look like in a magazine. And they push the narrative of this. And then, you know, like, there is the medical side of things. You know, there is the whole, you know, diabetes and all this stuff. But, yeah, how, because I bet you've had a couple of conversations around this, and I would love to get your opinion. Like, what do you think is the societal norm, like, that should be pushed, how do you navigate around that space?
I think it's really hard. It's really hard to navigate. Do you know what I mean? Like, and it goes back to that conditioning thing. And I'm not a doctor, and I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I'm a doctor, because I know what I know from my own life experience. You know what I mean? And I don't want to be reductive of health issues within the Pacific community. But also, my whole thinking around bodies, whether they're fat, small, or in between, is, shouldn't we get to a point where actually we're just showing care to everyone, regardless of what body size looks like? Like, don't we, from a humanity point of view, like, it shouldn't actually matter what your body looks like. Your body still deserves care. And I think this is something I've been having lots of conversations with people about, and I've received a lot of backlash around being a fat activist and the kind of conversations that I've had with different people, both fat bodies and straight size bodies. Like, I think there is a real uncomfortability that people have when you're talking about fatness, but I'm still trying to figure out the best way to navigate that, to be honest with you.
Yeah. That would be, you spoke about it at the start around having these uncomfortable conversations, and you know, we've already done like three of them, not for me, but you know, for society to have these uncomfortable conversations around gender, around masculinity, and around weight and fatness. And yeah, I find that I find that online is like social media is a beast when it comes to that shit, you know?
Yes, Paul, oi. Like, navigating social media is fuck, you know? Like, fuck. I actually have no words. Like, it feels really, really toxic sometimes to have to try and actively keep yourself safe in a digital space where it's so easy for people to be quite removed and just write whatever they want to write, and that's cool. And that's cool. Do you know what I mean? It's like, oh, I don't have to think of you, this person I'm writing about, as an actual person, because I have the luxury of hiding behind a keyboard, and I'm going to say whatever the fuck I like, and then it's done. And it's like, actually, we need to be a little bit more accountable to one another, even in digital space. That, would you say that to that person to their face? If you were actually in front of someone, would you still have the audacity to think that's appropriate? Because I don't
90% would be no, you know, or maybe even more. 98.5% would be, I wouldn't say that to their face. And I remember I put a tweet out the other day. It would have been thing is like, if you, like, I saw someone talk a shit about me, right? And like, bro, I just let it fly. I'm cool with that. I'm like, yeah, it was like, but I saw him in real life. I knew who he was. And I went up to him and I put my hand out and said, hey, bro, how are you? And he shook my hand back. And in my mind, I was like, you rat motherfucker. Like, you know, like, come on now. You show that same fucking energy. If you're about that life, don't shake my hand. Be like, nah, fuck you. You know, and I would appreciate that more. I would be like, cool, at least he's a real motherfucker. Then if he goes, oh, yeah, man. Oh, hey, bro, how's it going? Love your work. Like, get the fuck out of here. I know, you know, like, that's a lot of that shit happens.
I think it's because we also have this real need, and this is something I've been continually navigating, of wanting to be desperately liked.
Yes.
And the likability politics. Do you know what I mean? Because I've really thought about this lots as well, because for me, you get what you get with me. Like, I'm a pretty open book. I'm pretty transparent, and I tend to keep the same energy in every facet of my life. It's like, you know where you stand with me, and I appreciate when other people meet me on that same level, that if this is what you think, cool, this is what you think. And I think it's also just getting comfortable with being uncomfortable. This is what amazes me about, I don't know, I think we're navigating a time, especially on social media, where A, no one wants to get it wrong. Everyone's worried that they're going to get it wrong, and that, oh, you know, oh, I'm going to be uncomfortable. It's like, actually, it's okay to be uncomfortable. That's the best place to learn. And it's okay to get it wrong, but then rectify the behavior. And I think that's where, I guess, the social media space that we're all navigating can feel quite reductive at times, because people are so quick to go, they're fucking cancelled. Cancel them. They're done. Without actually taking the time to be like, hang on, we've got to get better at calling each other in instead of calling each other out.
Oh, yeah. What a great, I love that. You know, because I said it a couple of days ago too. I'm like, I'm glad that when I fucked up, there wasn't social media around, or there wasn't picture phones, or there wasn't people. I wasn't in a state of notoriety. Nobody knew who the fuck I was, you know, but I learned from that, and that's the only way I learned, was to fuck up. And then being like, holy shit, he fucked up. Yeah. Okay, well, let's see if he can rectify that. Cause I've seen people fuck up real bad on the internet.
Oh, mate, I have fucked up really in the past. And I've had the luxury of being able to do that in private, where people have said to me, hey, that was a bit messed up that you said that thing. Like, why did you say that? Can we unpack that? Can we have a conversation about that? And I've had the space to do that. I don't think people have the space to do that anymore without it being super reductive and just like, oh, well, you fucked up once, so let's crucify you and that's the end of you.
Yeah.
Like, end over.
Like, even I had to change my mindset, you know, because I was kind of like, and here's another thing too that comes with that, is there's always going to be an undercurrent of jealousy. Like, I'm jealous of that dude, or I'm jealous of that chick, and we don't even know it, but I do it all the time. I'm like, man, fuck that dude. But in my mind, I'm like, fuck, actually, it's not that I don't like him. It's that, like, I admire where he's at. And, you know, this is a, you know, like, people have that, this is my chance to pounce. Yeah, but, like, and I think that's where it comes from.
I don't think a lot of people are actually as self-aware as they would like to think they are. Because it's a lot of self-awareness to look at a situation and go, why am I responding that way? Like, why am I reacting this way? What is it about the situation where I'm seeing somebody else thrive that I'm feeling like, oh, fuck that guy, when actually there's enough space for everyone?
Yeah. And also, I think the other thing that comes with that too is not just how, like, does this directly affect me? Actually doesn't affect me at all. So why the fuck do I, like, why am I involving myself here? You know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think sometimes people just need to take a moment to maybe have a big, deep breath in and stand on some grass.
Yeah. And like, you know, if it doesn't hurt you, like, if it does have, like, if you've got nothing nice to say about somebody and it doesn't affect you, you shouldn't fucking say shit. Like, I've had some people go, you know, with the bakery stuff, like, oh, man, you're like, what's this? Like, you know, you're promoting this kind of, like, this eating shit. And I'm like, yo, shut up. Like, I get it. You own a gym. I get it. But, bro, shut the fuck up. Like,
That in itself, and this is something I've found really interesting when it comes to navigating space as a fat woman, is this insistent need to police other people's body. I don't get it. I'm like, this is my body, and actually it's none of your business what I do with my body. I'm not trying to police you. Just worry about yourself.
But people just, yeah, they just, it's that little Karen in them, that little Karen or that little Cecil that's like, hey, mate, bloody, you should fucking say something. And then you get on the computer and then, oh, fuck this guy. Oh, I don't like the look of your T-shirt. It's too short. I'm like, bro, shut the fuck up. The online space actually is probably the most fucking plastic community, and like, people will like you one day and then they'll fucking hate you and they don't give a shit about you. like I'm like, well, one day they will, but you know, like, it actually doesn't mean anything. It's the people that you hold close, your blood, your family, your kids, that actually mean more than anything.
And I mean, it's, for me, it's such a catch-22, because the positive side of social media, the positive side of having a digital space, has allowed me to be able to form a community with other fat women, with other queer people. Do you know what I mean? Like, FaffSwag was actually born on the internet initially. And so I can see the value in digital space as well, but I just think we need to get better at how we navigate that space. It can be quite harmful. And I, you know, I'm a well-informed adult woman. I just find it stresses me out to think how toxic that can be for our young people.
Yeah. And that there's no education going in about it either.
No.
You know, the government put in a digital curriculum and just left it. It doesn't have anything to do around how to keep yourself safe, you know, like etiquette on how to talk to people online. It's just, here's how to do some coding, here's how to, you know, it's nothing that they'll actually use, and it's actually quite alarming that there is nothing.
Well, you know, the internet feels unsafe to me as an adult a lot of the time. So I can imagine how unsafe it actually is for our young people to navigate, you know. And that was one of the things I struggled with last year in that initial lockdown, was actually having to be really mindful about how much I absorbed and consumed on the social media, because that was one of the big kind of concerns or worries of people. I'm like, Jesus Christ, we're in a fucking global pandemic, and the thing that you're worried about is coming out having a body that looks like mine? Like, really? Out of all of the things you could be worried about, the thing you're worried about is being fat? Like, okay, that's interesting.
Everybody else, like, it was funny when this lockdown happened. It's like, oh, time to get fat again. And I'm like, well, like, yeah, I kind of get that. I really don't give a fuck. I'm going hard. But I'm going hard in the paint with this one.
Is that really the worst thing that could happen to you in a global pandemic? Is your body going, holy shit, we're in a global pandemic and everyone is experiencing this like shared trauma. Obviously, my body is probably going to change, but hey, that's actually okay because I'm safe. I'm at home. Like, keep it in perspective.
Hey, can I ask you, like, to educate me a little bit around intersectionality?
Sure. What would you like to know?
I'm confused. Like, I want to know exactly. Like, I've heard it a few times. I've had it once on my podcast, actually. Penina Davidson, who is a basketball player, kind of learnt about it. But I was like, I get it, but I don't get it. Could you, like, just to explain the basics around it, what does it mean by, like, that?
So I, when I talk about my practice, I say I have an intersectional practice. And what I mean by that is that, or to put it into real layman's terms, how I look at intersectional, what is intersectional, right, is that we all have different lived experiences that meet somewhere. So the intersects of being brown, of being a woman, of being queer, of being fat, those are intersectional experiences that kind of collide together, if that makes sense. When you're talking about intersectionality, it's that you're recognizing, and this is a big conversation obviously within like feminist spaces, is that often in feminist spaces the voices that are the most loudest, who are given the most airtime generally, are white women, without actually going, hang on a minute, some of the most marginalized people we have in our community within feminist spaces, well, what about disabled women? What about queer women? What about brown women? Like, there's so many layers to just, it's not just about being a woman. There's a whole bunch of other struggles there that kind of collide and meet in the middle. And I guess that's my understanding of what intersectional is.
So in terms of mainstream media, like, are we seeing any growth there with keeping our mainstream media intersectional?
No. I don't think so. I think it's very slowly happening, and we're seeing, you know, a little bit more diversity, I guess, but it's very slow. It's never at the rate that I would hope it is moving at. Do you know what I mean? But in saying that, I feel like I'm really radical. I'm like, can we just fucking burn it down and start again? Like, can we just do that? But you can't do that, can you? It's a slow, and the older I get, the more I accept that it is a slow burn, that it's this constant kind of chipping away, and eventually, hopefully, we'll get to a point where we will see alternatives. In saying that, though, circling back to Fastwag again, that's the whole reason why we started doing what we were doing, is recognizing it's got to be led by us. It has to be done by us, for us, if we really want to see versions of ourselves that feel true to who we are. And I think in queer space generally, they're always pioneering, man, like the original pioneers are just going, okay, cool, so that space over there isn't gonna welcome us, we're just gonna build our own fucking table.
Do you, like, can you, like, how do you tell the difference, especially you'd know this, but how would you tell the difference between the intersectional practice of a place, and just the tokenism, like just getting, just get a Maori woman. She could just go and do this, you know?
I think it's, for me, because I've been reflecting on this a lot recently, and I think it's making sure that you are having those people engage from the get-go. Do you know what I mean? From the very first stages of a project, like if we're going to talk about a project, right? If you are going to go, okay, so I'm wanting to have this story about a queer disabled woman in South Auckland, then right from the jump, you should be talking to queer people, disabled people, brown women, and making sure you're having those voices from the very get-go, not having these fully realized ideas and then at the 25th hour going, oh, we should probably actually engage with someone from that community now, eh? We should probably get them on board. Also, pay these people, because this is another thing that happens, is that people want this kind of cultural advisory from these communities, but they don't always want to pay people. I'm like, pay people.
Wow, really? That's a thing?
Yeah, it really is.
Shit. You could think about, like, how much money some of these projects get. And just cutting off something for somebody that has saved your ass, pretty much. Like, if I look at, let's say we look at this Vegas thing that happened, right?
Yeah.
Where they didn't do their due diligence. They didn't get somebody in. And they had Australians that were running shit. And then they said, oh, no. Our front runner knows all about this stuff. But if they were to do that, pay somebody to go, nah, that's actually not what happens. That's, you know, they would have avoided a massive fucking, like, they had a lot of people coming at their neck.
Yeah, and I guess, like, because I've been thinking about what is story sovereignty, right? And I think we have enough people in our community, whether they be Māori practitioners or Pacifica practitioners or Asian practitioners, we have enough expertise now, in my opinion, that we can be the authors of our own narrative. And that comes from the top down. I do think that coalition is important. And don't get me wrong, like, I think there's plenty capable white producers who are producing work. But culturally, if we're going to have a conversation around the cultural competence, I don't think you have the same kind of cultural competence as people who have actually had that lived experience, in my opinion.
Because I think, speaking of like that, I think the Panthers, I just finished watching the Panthers, and I was like, you could tell that they were speaking like people that I know would speak. You know, there was a level of authenticity that shines through without trying to force it.
Yeah.
Yeah, as opposed to what I've seen other shows that try and force it, because you can obviously tell that somebody who, and I mean, the Sis show is a perfect example. You can tell that they lived that shit. That was real, and the whole cast and crew and everything is of Polynesian descent. So it was very interesting to, when you see shit, like, let's say Shortland Street, for instance, right? Just off the top. I haven't watched it for like fucking 15 years, but I know, I can remember bits where they were like, let's get a Samoan in here. And they put the Samoan in there, and then all of a sudden there's like this fake narrative that is not true.
Yeah. Yeah. Just circling back to Sis, I absolutely adore Hanel. Like, I've known Hanel for a really, really long time. We actually went to drama school together. And I just admire Hanel deeply, because I think she is a really good example of just how we as an industry can do things better, of actually bringing up and nurturing younger emerging practitioners behind us. That's really important. And modelling that to a kind of teina relationships. I love her now. I think she's amazing, and I'm really proud of all the work that she's been doing.
What I love the most is that they're not, like, they're unapologetic about asking, like, if there's anybody, I remember there was a tweet or a message that she put out. If there's anybody that wants to be a part of the show and do it, and she had lists of things that if you're in this, and then down the bottom is like, Māori Pacifica will take preference over anybody, or, you know, and I was like, yes, sir. Like, that's the shit. Like, we need more of that shit. Like, goddamn.
Absolutely. I think that's, you know, in terms of strengthening our industry and strengthening our communities, like, you've got to just make sure you're nurturing those people and giving them pathways, especially now when there's actually, in terms of, you know, tertiary education, there's not a lot of programs left anymore specifically for performing arts. Like, they've all kind of dried up. The amazing art school that they had at MIT, that's now gone. PEEPA's gone. You know, all these pathways for our people to develop their skill set and their craft, if that's the path you choose, there's not really anything left.
So what is happening in that space? Because I didn't even know that.
Nothing, really. Like, you've got, there's still Toi Whakaari and Unitech, and then you have the Actors Program, which is another training space. But in terms of art spaces that are, you know, developing our next generation at a tertiary level, there's nothing in South Auckland anymore that I'm aware of. I could be wrong, but as far as I know, there's none of those pathways there anymore, which makes it even more important and more vital that for us mid-career practitioners in the industry, that we're making sure we're creating pathways for emerging practitioners to come into.
That sucks. Like, where is the pathway? Like, I know, and I hate to generalize things, but I know that there will be plenty of, you know, like acting schools and things like that in Central Auckland and North Shore. But if we look at the amount of talent that has come out of the South Side, the record is immaculate. Like, you know, we're talking about some of the most talented people, you know, talented actors that have ever come out of New Zealand. But yeah, that sucks, man.
It does suck. And I think that's just why it's important to also, you know, like, my pathway into the arts and into what I do was a little bit unconventional, because I did start my performing arts degree at Unitech. I was doing the Bachelor of Performing and Screen Arts acting major. And then I got hapū with my boy, and so I left. And then when I went to go back to finish my degree, I got really, really sick. So I kind of thought, oh, the universe is telling me that this is obviously not a part of my journey. So for me, I've kind of just learnt as I've gone, and through the relationships that I have with, you know, peers and my friends, and I've learned that way. So I took quite an unconventional way of, like, getting to the point of my career that I am now. And so I would say just figure it out for yourself as well. There's other ways into the industry or into the arts that you don't have to go through tertiary education. It helps. It absolutely helps. And in terms of, like, honing your craft, I think it's very useful. But also, I think sometimes we don't put enough importance on just connect with other artists. Find your community, find your people, and then, like, nurture those relationships.
Because, I've noticed that too. Like, I see it happen all the time. Like, I did drama in high school just to muck around. Like, I was just hanging with my boys, and we were, like, playing around. And then I remember my teacher was like, man, you're actually pretty good at this if you stop mucking around. And then that was the last time I did anything. I was like, yeah, okay, thank you. And then, but now I see so many really talented social media people, like, people that have no backing and have never done stuff. And
I think the other thing too is that often, and this is why I kind of really hammer this home and I'm engaging with young brown people, we are often conditioned to not think that art is a serious pathway. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's not a legitimate job. And it is a legitimate job. And there is ways that you can thrive in arts and entertainment that will sustain you. I mean, it's hard. Do you know what I mean? Like anything, and a career in the arts is really hard, and you're trying to juggle multiple things all at once all the time. But I would really urge people that if that's something you want to do, especially our young people, if being creative is something that you want to eventually have as your career, keep pushing.
Mm. Yeah, it's I really hope. I actually went to school with I went to school with a couple of actors, and you know, to see them grow and to see them kind of. But that was the other thing, is like the drama teacher at the time that they were there. Like she was on, like she was awesome. Fire Olivia was her name, and I was like, man, she's choice. But then I ended up doing all the tech stuff for their plays and things, and I was just like, man, I wish I kind of kept going. This is mean, yeah. But at the time, I was like, I'd rather go play basketball with my boys and fuck around and be an idiot and tag up some fences, and then that was my pathway. And it's cool to see that, like, my bro Tavai, who's killing it, and you know, like, you see them, and like I seen them on Panthers. I'm like, damn, bro, that's mean, you know, and you're proud of that. But yeah, it's interesting how one good teacher can change everything.
Absolutely. And I don't think, well, and I'm only speaking from my own experience, but I don't think as brown people we are allowed to dream as much as our white counterparts.
I see. I know where you're going with that one.
I think we're told to be practical because life's hard, you know what I mean? And like, I've been really fortunate that my mum and dad have always been super supportive of my dreams and goals and have never made me think that I can't do anything, you know? And like, I remember growing up, my dad always used to say to us, If you choose to be a rubbish man, then be the happiest, best rubbish man that you can be. That just to find your happiness, chase your joy, dream big. Even if those dreams sound mental to everybody else or outlandish, like, keep dreaming. And I don't think as brown people, we are allowed the space to dream, to be honest with you.
I love that, eh? Yeah, and I think we need to have more of these corridors. I think especially around, just being able to dream and just keeping the dreams alive, like, you know.
And look, yeah. I get it, because I say this from a really privileged point of view, and I recognize my privilege in saying that. But I come from working class stock, you know, like both sides of my family, my Pākehā family and my Niuean side of my family, have all been grafters and grinders and really hard workers. And so, you know, being able to have the space and encouragement from my family of being allowed to dream and dream big, you know, like real big, sometimes probably bigger than maybe I should, I feel really fortunate, because I know for a lot of our people, they don't have that luxury. They're actually just navigating life and trying to find where you're going to put the next meal on the table. Those are very real struggles for people. So it can be very hard to dream when you're just trying to survive.
Yes, I agree. I agree a lot, because I mean, I remember growing up, my mom was a single mother, and for her to just kind of hold it all together and still let me be me, you know, was huge. But at the same time, I always remember kind of thinking, like, what is my dream? And like finding a purpose too is another thing. Like there's a lot of times that it took me a while. Like, it takes people a while to find out what they're like. I thought I was good at one thing, and then all of a sudden it's like, no, this is where your path is going to take you. And then just doubling down on that, that's a huge thing too.
Yeah, I know. I think it's also because we all have a tendency to think from a place of scarcity, and I have been actively trying every day in my life to try and think from a place of abundance and how important that actually is, because a lot of it is mental, right? Like, you've got to, if you're not having clarity up here, how can then you actually put that into practical practice?
Yeah.
So for me, I just think there's actually enough space for everyone. And like, I'm so tired of seeing our community surviving. I imagine what it would be like to see us thriving? Like, what does it look like as Māori, as Pacifica people? Like, what does us thriving look like? Like, what a yum idea of thinking about us as a collective of people, as a culture of people. Like, what does it look like when we thrive together? You know what I mean? Like, because we have we obviously have individuals who have really succeeded, and that is absolutely wonderful. But like, what does collective thriving look like?
Shit. I never even thought of that, eh? Like, yeah, I've never. That's very simple. When I was in, when I went to Japan, I was on the train there. I was only there for like 2 weeks, but I was on the train and I was wondering, like, from a Māori perspective, I was like, well, this is what happens when no colonization went on. Like, there was no Western colonized. You know, the Spanish didn't come through. You know, the Chinese tried to, but they got pushed away. You know, and I wonder what New Zealand would have been like, you know, and I probably get a lot of, we go, oh, there were savages, there were this, there were that, when they weren't, you know, and, you know, like, if we go back.
That's a false narrative, isn't it?
Yeah.
That I think, when I think about, that seems to be a constant thing that comes up of, oh, the noble colonizer who came in and saved us all and did us a favor because we were all unruly. And it's like, well, no, I don't know how much of that is true. Yeah.
And the narrative comes from the oppressor. Like, the oppressor is the one that writes the narrative. Like, they're the ones that saying, yeah, we're the best, you know. But the other thing too was the culture. Like, Everybody knew about things that happened in the past. Like, it's part of their schooling. Like, you need to know about this, absolutely, this, this, and this.
Well, but there's nothing like that now. It's easy to control the narrative when you're the only voice at the table, right?
Mm. Gosh, this is it's so true. And I'm just kind of like, I'm sitting on the train thinking, man, like, look at all this technology, look at all this cool thing, look at the way they are with people, how nice they are to people, you know, and they were on an island in the, you know, in the corner of the Pacific, on the top corner, but still, like, we're on the other corner, we could have been like that too, like, you know, but here we are kind of talking about it, you know, the what ifs, but yeah, it was really, I don't know, it just popped in my head, like, holy, this is really it made all sense, you know?
I mean, I think it's a beautiful thought, though, right? I think that's why Black Panther resonated with people so deeply, because it's this idea of, well, what would a reality where you didn't have colonialism, what would that look like for people?
Mm.
How would that have changed the culture? Like, what would the culture look like if you had been able to be left alone and thrive?
Oh, man. You unpack that. I mean, Black Panther could be the unpacking of that movie, you know, it goes so deep. Like, there's so many little intricate details. And this conversation has been amazing. Like, I've learned, and this is what's cool about it. This is why I'm so happy I have a podcast, is I can get people like you on and just learn from you and understand things that I normally wouldn't. Like, who am I going to ask about these kind of things? Like, you know, I don't know. So I'm really thankful for your time, eh?
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you for inviting me to yarn with you. Anyone that knows me knows I'm just like an absolute yarn spinner. You don't have to ask me twice. I'm like, what? I get to talk. Okay, cool. Let's do that. I think it's really important.
I think this is like the first of many. Like, I'm going to, like, I've got so many, like, more things that are, and that's the cool thing about, like, me though, is that, like, I'll ask questions that people want to ask, but they probably wouldn't. Like, they're just kind of like, oh, I don't want to offend or anything, but I'll say it in a way that comes across curious. And I really just want to know, like, you know.
This is the thing though, like, human beings are inquisitive by nature. And I think, I don't know, like, I think at one point or another, we've got into this very strange space of like feeling like we can't just ask, which is weird because that's how I learn. I'm a lot like you. I'll ask. I never want to assume anything, so I'll ask. And sometimes those questions are like probably quite confronting for people, but I'm like, well, at least I asked. I didn't just assume that that was how it is.
Yeah. Yeah. What's the, coming back to Mangere for a second, like you grew up in Mangere?
So I moved to Mangere when I was 15, and those are obviously quite informative years of your life.
Yeah.
But I love Mangere. I wouldn't want to live anywhere else, to be honest with you.
Mangere is like, there's this thing about it, eh? When you come off Massey Road and you go towards it, you're just like, yeah, slowly but surely you get there and you're just like, wow, this is a really nice place. You just see the houses on Massey Road. They're all nicely done and there's flags out the front and, you know, kids are playing out there. And then you get, yeah, it's such a nice place. And then you go to Mangere Bridge, and then it's like, that's where they pushed all the white people, just, bam, get over there.
Yeah, in Mangere, like, this is, like, somewhere different. Yeah, I think the community energy in Mangere is something very special. And, you know, like, for me and my siblings growing up, we lived in Ellerslie, and we went to Ellerslie Primary, you know, and so for a long time, I was having this conversation with my brother the other day, actually. I thought being Niuean, I mean, it is super special, but I thought it was ultra special because we were the only Niuean kids in our school.
Wow.
You know, like, I would say there was probably maybe a handful of Polynesian and Māori families at the school. It's a very, very white school. And so going from that and then moving out to Mangere, it was like, oh my God, there's all these brown people. Like, this is great. I love this. And my mum is Pākehā, so she was a bit of a, that was quite funny, actually. I was like, how the roles have reversed, mum. Now it's like, spot the whitey, eh?
Oh, man. Shout outs to Mangere. I love Mangere. I used to go out there every week to go to basketball and play there, play at the rec center. And then, yeah, I knew where all the spots were. I know where to get all the mean taro and fried chicken. I knew where that spot was.
I think there's just a cultural experience that you will have in Mangere that you wouldn't find anywhere else, and I think that's what makes it so special. Like, the joy that my heart gets when I go to Mangere Town Centre and you've got all the little nanas and koros doing their Zumba in the middle of the town centre, it just makes me so happy. I'm like, you wouldn't, I just love it. I love this community.
So
I think it gets a bad rap sometimes, but it's just like, leave South Auckland alone.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. I've got to wrap it up. I'm running out of storage space.
Oh, but good.
Thank you so much for your time. If people want to find you, people want to get in touch with you, where would they find you? Where's the best place?
I'm probably, I guess, on Instagram or through FaffSwag, just generally. Yeah. Or Facebook, you can Facebook me. I don't know. I'm usually like pretty low key, to be honest with you.
Well, you never know. There might be somebody that resonates with you, and then you go, "Hey, man, I really enjoyed the podcast you did," and you know, like, yeah. But now this is not the last we're going to hear of you. We're going to have, we're going to bring you on another time because I've got a lot more questions.
Yeah, cool, Kane.
All right, have a great afternoon. Have a great afternoon, and we'll talk soon, eh?
Yep, you show.